Welcome back, everyone. So we've got a few small announcements to make. If you have any questions or wishes or even memes, suggestions maybe, you can post them on Mastodon with the hashtag Shonks23. If you want to ask some questions, we've got a public viewing, including some Q&A in AJETC. The link for that can be found on our info beamer between talks. You can ask questions directly in the chat on YouTube or on Twitch, or by joining the channel Shonks23 on irc.hackin.org. That link is also on our streaming page at streaming.media.ccc.de. Also on streamingmedia.ccc.de, you will find a link to the relive, so you can rewatch parts of the talk until we properly release it. So, today I've got Dr. Vera Wild with me. Dr. Vera Wild is a political scientist with 15 years' experience studying bias, technology, and health. After completing National Science Foundation-supported PhD and postdoctoral research at the University of Virginia, UCLA, and Harvard, she co-created the website iBorderControl.no. Today, she'll talk about chat control, mass screenings, massive dangers. At the intersection of bias and public po at the intersection of bias and public policy, the upcoming talk is on the fundamental fallacy and emergent dangers of mass screening technology. Surely there will also be some comically weird memes in there too. So, give it away.
Good afternoon. My name is Vera Wild. I'm a political scientist and research methodologist, and I'm here to talk to you today about chat control, mass screenings, massive dangers. Now, I know you thought you were getting to talk about fancy technology, but first I want to talk to you about phishing. Trawling, specifically, is a phishing method where you pull a big net behind the boat and sort through what it catches later. Now, one of the big problems with trawling is that it produces a large bycatch, stuff you don't mean to catch in the net, but you do, because the net has to be small enough to get what you want, and that means it's going to catch other stuff too. The classic example is tuna fishing, catching anything tuna-sized and anything bigger than the net holds, but that's most of the ocean, like tortoises and dolphins. This is of a cheetah caught in a net. It's a species of porpoise native to the northern Gulf of California. It's endangered, as in there may be as few as 10 left in the world. It is the world's rarest marine animal. So bycatch is a big problem for vaquitas, but it's not just a big problem for vaquitas. It kills about 38 million tons of marine animals annually, or 40% of fish that are caught. For obvious reasons, the size of the net holes. The problem is worse for some fishing operations than for others. For example, if you're trying to catch shrimp, if you get a kilogram of shrimp, you're going to get 5 to 20 kilograms of bycatch. Annually, bycatch kills about 300,000 small whales and dolphins, 250,000 endangered turtles, and 300,000 birds. So, why am I talking to you about fishing? Well, the structure of the problem of trawling applies to a lot of other problems. If you think about this application as one of many, the target as one of many, and the bycatch as one of many examples of bycatch, then you'll see what I mean. Take, for example, polygraph programs, also known as lie detectors. I did a lot of research on these in my PhD and postdoctoral research, and the history of them in the US is that the Department of Energy once wanted to use polygraphs on all of the scientists in the national labs in an effort to weed out spies. The problem with this is that they turn up a lot of false positives, and the investigations can go into all sorts of personal terrain. There aren't protections like people might imagine for religious, political, or sexual behavior, orientation, or belief. And these investigations can really tear people apart. The same problem comes up with a similarly structured program, iBorder Control, which is an AI lie detector recently piloted at non-Schengen borders in Europe with EU Horizon 2020 funding to the tune of around 4 million euros. Here the target is bad crossings, and the bycatch is innocent crossings. And you can imagine kind of the same order of magnitude badness of a scenario when you have false positives who may be, for example, asylum seekers who have just been through all kinds of hell. They're asked, well, where are you coming from? Where are you going? And this triggers trauma, this triggers stress, and they're being interrogated by security forces who think, you know, the machine says that you're trying to get away with something. And then we come to the topic of today's talk, chat control. This is a proposed program in the EU to scan all digital communications for evidence of child sexual abuse material, from kiddie porn to grooming. And the problem is, again, with bycatch, that predominantly what this program would catch is innocent communications. And the means that's proposed for this is to do to require private corporations to do client-side scanning using an AI tool. So again, you can imagine the kinds of investigations that would need to result in order to sort true from false positives. You would have predominantly innocent people, and a lot of them being subjected to potentially personal, intimate investigations that could tear them apart, tear their families apart. Then we get into medicine, where there are similarly structured programs in a lot of areas. Asymptomatic cancer screenings are one that some people will be familiar with, where the target is deaths and the bycatch is healthy people. And what that looks like in practice is, for example, for mammography for early breast cancer detection, about 10% of women will be false positives. And that means that they'll experience anxiety, disfigurement, potentially from biopsy or even mastectomy, partial or whole. They could experience infection or even death from these risky surgeries that may not be necessary. There's also uncertainty about potential harm from parts of the process like needle biopsies, compression, cumulative radiation exposure, increasing cancer risk if you repeatedly go in for mammography. And there's uncertainty about the net death risk or benefit. And that means there's no established all-cause mortality benefit from cancer screenings like mammography, or for men, PSA testing for early prostate cancer detection, or colonoscopy for early colon cancer detection. We're just not sure if these things ultimately save lives. And beyond medicine, in education, there are programs that share the same structure. Again, looking for a target that's rare, like plagiarism or AI use in writing, and catching predominantly innocent students. So if you can imagine schools, universities, other educational institutions buy software licenses or contract to companies to use their software to look for these problems. And then when they flag students and students say, well, I didn't do it, I'm innocent, they have no way to prove that. And that can have, you know, lasting impacts on somebody's educational opportunities. And digital communication platforms also use similarly structured programs to conduct mass scanning for misinformation and disinformation. And there the bycatch is ambiguity or dissent. You know, there are a lot of things where the truth is uncertain, the facts are ambiguous. And these kinds of communications could be erroneously flagged and censored. So these programs look very different, but underneath they share a common mathematical structure. These are all mass screenings for low prevalence problems. They're all signal detection problems. And because they share that structure, they share a lot of problems. What is this thing? This is a replica of Archimedes' 3rd century BC odometer, reconstructed in modern Greece by Kostas Kotsanas. An odometer measures how far a wheeled vehicle goes. So this is a cool gizmo. Is this AI? Would we regulate these things today as AI? It's not a silly question, actually, because there are different definitions of AI, and we end up regulating things sometimes that we don't want to regulate. There's certainly overlap between mass screenings for low prevalence problems and AI, as AI and digitalization increase infrastructural capacities to deliver services. You see a lot of programs with this structure using AI. And the EU Parliament's draft AI Act recommended banning several AIs sharing this structure. They recommended banning emotion recognition AI, like that recently piloted in iBorder Control, as well as real-time biometrics and predictive policing in public spaces, and social scoring. The final version of the AI Act classified them all as high risk. But it's not an AI problem, it's about the structure of this program, and this applies to a much broader range of technologies. And society has an interest in thinking more broadly about mass screens that don't involve AI, like mammography for breast cancer, PSA testing for prostate cancer, and gestational diabetes screening for pregnant women. The conditions, notably inferential uncertainty, or uncertainty about what we should infer from this cue of the test result, they vary across realms like security and medicine in ways that are worth thinking about to guide sensible policy. So where does it end? That's a bit about how the structure scales up in the abstract to different kinds of programs and technologies in relation to AI. We could also think about mass preventive interventions, not screenings for low prevalence problems, things that do something instead of testing somebody for something. Mandatory COVID vaccination and boosting in children and young adults is an example of this. The discredited DARE, or Drug Abuse Resistance Education program in the US and in other places, is another. We could think about scaling up to random screening, which is also often bad. And then in terms of bycatch, laws writ large are basically all bycatch almost all of the time. For example, the law to not murder anyone applies to us all. Hopefully none of us is a murderer. Or to pick a more mundane example, there's a lot of bureaucracy around medical records. It's normal to have to sign a data release, to have an office keep your data. Some offices won't email you your results. They will only mail or fax them, because everybody has a fax machine. Or they'll just make you come in. And this is because of strong data protection laws in Germany, due in part to the Nazi and Stasi legacies. But when I want my blood work and I can't get it without going out when it's -2 outside, that's bycatch. One of the reasons to extend the logic out this far is to make the point that the argument isn't that these programs are always bad, right? We need laws. Sometimes we want these programs, sometimes we don't. It's not that I hate screening. It's that we need the net harm-benefit analysis to know which programs help instead of hurting society. My focus is on this smallest subset of this structure, mass screenings for low prevalence problems, because these screening contexts make for especially clear logic and math, because the outcomes are binary, because the screening test introduces this artificial construct of a binary outcome. And then the outcome of interest is already defined by the test structure, unlike in interventions like COVID vaccination, where it could be disputed what the outcome of interest is. Somebody might say it's hospitalization, another person might say it's myocarditis. The rest of this talk proceeds as follows. I want to talk about problems in principle, problems in practice, and solutions at the system level. The two main principal problems the two main points that I want to make about the problems in principle are about education and incentives. We're going to discuss the implications of probability theory, and then how to counterbalance perverse incentives. One of the things that people often say when my research comes up is that technology is developing so fast, AI is so good, that better technology is going to solve this problem. This is techno-solutionism, and it reflects a prominent myth that once we have better technology, accuracy will tip the scales and there will be no possible net harm from these programs. better technology will solve the problems of mass screenings for low prevalence problems in terms of false positives, which I've talked about in terms of bycatch, false negatives, which are also a serious problem, and zero-sum resource expenditure here, taking away from targeted investigations, screens, or care, which is another potential cost of these programs. When it's acknowledged that we do indeed have to worry about net harm, we usually hear talk of striking a balance, especially in security discourse. We hear about trading some liberty for some security, and people usually assume that one day better technology will tip the scales if it hasn't already. This misconception reflects a lack of understanding about the implications of probability theory, and specifically the mathematical theorem known as Bayes' theorem or Bayes' rule. I'm not going to throw Bayes' theorem at you. I'm just naming it so that you can find that anchor later if you want to learn more, or if you know more, you can anchor to it. So what's the problem here? Net harm is possible from these programs, and probability theory implies that we need to be especially concerned about it under conditions of rarity, because even with high accuracy and low false positive rates, the sheer volume involved in screening entire populations for rare problems generates either many false positives or many false negatives in the accuracy error trade-off. We also need to be alert for conditions of uncertainty, because when real-world scientific testing cannot validate results, inferential uncertainty persists. And we need to be on the lookout for secondary screening harm, because when secondary screening to reduce that uncertainty carries serious costs and risks, resultant harm may outweigh benefit for the overwhelming majority of affected people. This is why former Sandia senior scientist Al Zelikoff wrote in the Washington Post that the National Academy of Sciences 2003 polygraph report concluded mass screening of lab scientists would be, quote, worse than worthless. And the same goes for mass screenings for low prevalence problems as a class, that they risk net damaging exactly the values and people they're intended to protect, according to the implications of probability theory. Let's see an empirical demonstration. This is just to start out, this is an anecdote from UT Austin Assistant Professor Sociology Sarah Brain's LAPD Gotham fieldwork that appeared in The Intercept in 2021. The police were waxing eloquent about this technology, but up close, what she saw was an engineer narrow a search by making questionable assumptions repeatedly. And when she asked him what happened, if there was a false positive, he said, "I don't know." So some people in science will roll your eyes and go, "Yeah, we know that." But in tech and in the real world, I think there's a common myth that in the field, technology is slick and professionals have it under control. They know how it works underneath the hood. But the reality is that these true versus false positive and true versus false negative conflicts are irresolvable. They are under-recognized in the field. And often the technology can't be or hasn't been validated, and the professionals don't know about these problems. So this is a drawing that represents the structure of all of these security program mass screenings for low prevalence problems. And you can see some people fail the test, they're baddies. Some people fail the test, they're innocents. The problem with looking at test results in this way is that it illustrates the common cognitive distortion of base rate blindness, also known as the base rate fallacy. And that pervades how most people perceive the resulting outcomes. This is what people are envisioning when they point out that these tests catch a lot of baddies. The problem is that they're ignoring the inverse that compares the number of those who are not caught baddies for baddies or those who are innocent and wrongly flagged. And we want to look at both outcomes for both sides. And that looks like the picture on the right. We've just zoomed out to see the bigger picture, and this perspective corrects for the base rate fallacy because it lets you see the base rate of badness versus innocence is quite low, And what that implies is that the common thing, innocence, overwhelms the rare thing, badness, among failures as in the general population. And that correction lets you intuitively, visually make a fairer comparison. Another way to represent the same outcomes so that it may still be clearer that there are four outcomes instead of just two, and it also offers more precision, is in a so-called confusion matrix or error matrix, which is just a table showing how an algorithm performs at a classification task. This table comes from the National Academy of Sciences Polygraph Report from 2003, and it shows the results of polygraph interpretation assuming better than state-of-the-art accuracy in a hypothetical population of 10,000 people, including 10 spies. If you just look at the spy column at first, then it shows the polygraph hypothetically better than state-of-the-art accuracy. It shows the polygraph catching 8 out of 10 spies, which looks pretty good. But if you zoom out to look also at the non-spy column, then you see that there are 1,598 non-spies failing. And what that means, because there's a total of 1,606 people failing, is that there's a 99.5% probability that someone classified as deceptive was really telling the truth, or somebody classified as a spy was really a non-spy. That's an almost 16% chance that an innocent person fails, 20% chance that a spy passes, and there are almost 200 innocent people failing for each spy caught. So what this shows is the empirical rationale for what would be the typical Bayesian default about mass screenings for low prevalence problems, which is that these things cannot work without extremely high and damaging false positive rates. The same structure of a confusion matrix applies to binary screening tests in general, because they have this positive, negative, false, true structure. But it's important to keep in mind that in the real world, we often don't know what category a particular case or person goes in. This table scales up, the polygraph table, to the chat control context. It assumes a 1 in 1,000 child sexual abuse material base rate, an 80% detection threshold, and a 0.90 accuracy index, scanning 10 billion messages, which is just a fraction of daily European emails, and the proposed program would scan all digital communications, essentially. So this would generate over 1.5 billion false positives. There's again a 99.5% probability that a message flagged as abusive would be innocent. I say again because it's the exact same math as in the polygraph table. There's an almost 16% chance that an innocent message would get flagged. 20% of the time, abuse would evade detection. And there would be almost 200 messages mistakenly flagged for each abusive message found. And that's just for the tough version of the algorithm set to detect the majority of abuse. We could also run this program in friendly mode or whatever to minimize false positives instead of detect the majority of abuse and get the alternate outcome spread shown below that one here. This is the problem, that these programs don't offer just one bad option. They offer what the National Academy of Sciences on polygraphs called an unacceptable choice between bad options. Talk of striking a balance misses this point, that many mass screenings for low prevalence problems will never work as intended because the problems they target are too rare. Our uncertainty about whether they exist in a given case or not is too persistent in the real world. The test doesn't solve that. And secondary screenings to disambiguate true from false alarms cause too much harm for mass use to accrue net benefit. So we're left with this irresolvable tension that these tests look like they're clarifying things, but these binary classifications really yield four types of results. And we're stuck in this bind, where maximizing true positive rates and minimizing false positive rates are in tension. both have implications for practical outcomes of interest, like security. And we're stuck in this bond due to the accuracy error trade-off or dilemma, which is the empirical trade-off in any signal detection problem between sensitivity and specificity, or true and false negatives and positives, empirical outcome spreads that don't map directly onto values that we want to maximize, like security or liberty or balance, depending on your point of view. So why are we stuck in this crummy trade-off? Some people have a conception of science where we're not, where, for example, in lie detection research, there's this idea that we're going to find the holy grail of deception detection, if we haven't already, that we're going to find either a physiological response or, a verbal pattern. We're going to find something that really has a one-to-one correspondence with what we're trying to detect. And there are perfect cues, but mostly that's not the structure of the world. Mostly we have probabilistic associations. And as long as the cues are probabilistic, as long as that's the structure of the world and the outcomes that we're interested in, that invokes the accuracy error trade-off. There is no exit from this statistical reality through technology, because technology doesn't affect the world, it just categorizes it. So this is not a technology problem. Increasing accuracy doesn't solve it, because imperfection persists in the correspondence. Probabilistic association is the core of the problem, where we want to use the information in these imperfect cues, but we have to be careful about the context in which we use them and the inferences that we make from them. So let's talk about uncertainty. For those of you keeping track of where we are in the outline to budget your attention, this is the real-world pivot of the talk, out of mathematical structure and into real life, stuff that arises in the real application. Sometimes mass screenings can be great. When are they great? When are they probably a bad idea? Well, when inferential uncertainty persists, they can eat up a lot of resources and ultimately not accrue net benefits to society. But when there's a second order sure thing test so that we can really sort true from false positives, then society can benefit a lot from these programs. An example is HIV screening for all pregnant women, which is standard throughout the world, even in countries like Germany, where thankfully the prevalence is very, very low. And the reason that this makes sense is because there are really pretty good second-order tests to disambiguate true from false positives when you do HIV testing. But contrast this with something like lie detection, where we don't have a psychic x-ray to figure out for sure if somebody was lying or not. We just have the test result that says whether they were lying. So uncertainty like this raises the scientific problem of test validation under real-world conditions, which we often cannot solve. What do I mean by that? I mean, there's no way of assessing a test's accuracy and error in the real world, as opposed to under lab conditions. This is Steven Feinberg. I'm going to let this guy explain more about the validation problem. Steven Feinberg was a public statistician, a professor of statistics and social science at Carnegie Mellon University, and member of the National Academy of Sciences. He co-chaired the 2003 Polygraph Report. He did a lot of other work for the National Academies, and really focused his life on using his statistical mana and his social mana to make forensics in the U.S. more scientific. And his work led to major reform efforts translating statistical knowledge into courtroom practice. So he saved a lot of lives. And after he co-chaired the National Academy of Sciences Polygraph Report, he spent a lot of time for the rest of his life speaking out against next generation polygraph programs like future attribute screening technology, which was a 2008 Department of Homeland Security program that purported to read travelers' minds with their physiology. And he said, you know, I would be for it if there were something that we could use to catch the man or woman who wants to get on the airplane and blow it up. I would be willing to surrender some liberties if there were a device that really I had some confidence that it worked. But there's a major difference between asking people about something that you can verify and asking them about something that you can't. That's the essence of the validation problem, that there are a lot of accuracy numbers coming out of security programs that are trialed under lab conditions, not under real enough real world conditions where we don't know the answer and therefore we can't validate the tool under the appropriate conditions. So the validation problem carries really far in mass screenings for low prevalence problems. You might think that it applies only to contexts where somebody's done something wrong and they want to hide it. And that's certainly an especially big problem. But even in medical contexts, even in something like cancer screenings, which you might think are easier than security because nobody's trying to hide what they've done, and you can image, you can do a biopsy. Surely you can know if someone has cancer in a way that you can't examine a slice of someone's psyche and know if they're lying or if they're a criminal. But there's still, even in the medical realm, persistent inferential uncertainty about whether lives are net saved by mass screenings like mammography, PSA testing for prostate cancer, and colonoscopy. And these all-cause mortality benefits are arguably what we should care about, because we don't just want to create cancer patients, we want to save lives. So that uncertainty highlights the importance of considering secondary screening harms. This table is from the Harding Center for Risk Literacy, and what it shows is that in a sample of 1,000 women participating in mammography screening, one life is saved from breast cancer death, but we don't know about all-cause mortality. And for that saved life, about 100 women experience a false alarm, so they have additional testing or tissue removal, they may have partial or complete removal of a breast, and these things will have effects on their quality of life. And we also, again, don't know about possible iatrogenesis from needle biopsy, compression, radiation exposure. These are uncertainties. So it's the same story, basically, as with other mass screenings for low prevalence problems, where the common false positives overwhelms the rare true positives. But notably, in this context, that means secondary screening harms affect 10% of women. There's another sort of possible harm that doesn't make it into this type of picture, and that's the cases that don't get the same attention because resources are being used on mass screenings. Mass screenings for low prevalence problems that target the entire population take resources that may then not be available to investigate symptomatic patients in medicine or specific information about possible crime and security. My hypothesis is that uncertainty aversion links both in medicine, overdiagnosis, overtreatment, and underdiagnosis, and security. Some scholars talk about over-policing and under-security or under-policing. My hypothesis is that increasing quantification, tracking with increased bureaucratic demands for proof and certainty, make it easier for busy clinicians and other experts and precarious researchers to run and act on the results of defensible standardized screening tests than they do for the same groups to listen to complex patient histories or crime reports and spend time thinking about discussing and experimenting to solve the implicated puzzles. So uncertainty aversion would then be the psychosocial link driving suboptimal medical care, policing, and other professional behavior, causing common and preventable harm across many domains. And at the top level, this hypothesis has its roots in leading methodologist and statistics reformer Sandra Greenland's work on improving statistics education by bringing cognitive science to bear on it, emphasizing the need to recognize ambiguity and uncertainty in most scientific results and interpretations, and to turn a critical reflective lens on science as a social product of human actors. So going back to the confusion matrices for binary screening tests, like the ones we're looking at showing four outcomes, true and false, right and wrong. This is a heuristic, and it leaves out uncertainty to simplify, but we don't actually have a way of knowing in real life what is a true and false, positive and negative on a case-by-case basis often. So typically, people will map, for example, liberty onto false positives when we're having a security debate. But in reality, if you envision different colors representing different values in a candy wrapper, and a candy wrapper representing a case, we could imagine the candies unwrapping and the colors re-aggregating from all four cells into a new amalgamation. So the point with that thought experiment is that we need to make better maps because these mismappings are common. And this type of mismapping on the level of logic is called statistical reification. It's another common cognitive bias in science and beyond that Sandra Greenland calls attention to. He defines it as treating hypothetical data distributions and statistical models as if they reflect known physical laws rather than speculative assumptions for thought experiments. In other words, it's one thing to look back at family photos and imagine how they fit into what else you know in the whole picture using lots of different types of evidence. But it's something else entirely to treat them as the backbone of the whole story or as a heuristic you can rely on to make an important decision. So mismapping is reification. Trading some liberty for security isn't on the table, even though we often hear talk of this trade. This is a fraudulent trade. The high costs of false positives accrue to liberty and security alike. And we just want to watch the ball of where these values are really going, where they're reaggregating to, which is an empirical problem that requires empirical solutions. And we need to tackle the empirical problems because risk aversion gets risky fast. So let's talk about these empirical solutions. For those of you keeping track of where we are on the outline, this is the last leg of the talk, moving into solutions at the system level. Science has some widely accepted standards for how we can advance evidence and evidence. One is that proponents should bear the burden of proof to establish that new interventions will do more good than harm. Another is that independent reviewers need to evaluate the evidence of claimed costs and benefits. Relevant data must be public, including information about its production, storage, analysis, and interpretation. And we need to structure programs to yield better efficacy data. This may all sound really basic, so it's worth noting that society doesn't already work this way. Let's look at an example. This is the Better Regulation Agenda website from the EU Commission. It emphasizes evidence-based policymaking, as you can see, but it does not establish a mechanism for assessing whether proposals would work. What does it establish in terms of mechanism? Well, it says the European Commission is responsible for planning, preparing, and proposing new EU laws and policies, also for evaluating them, and proposing improvements when necessary in policy reviews and monitoring the implementation. They list a Have Your Say portal that lets people respond to a call for evidence. They say since 2021, the main highlights of the Better Regulation Revised Agenda include improved public consultations by introducing a single call for evidence translated in all languages on the revamped Have Your Say portal. The approach combines the feedback on roadmaps and inception impact assessments with the questionnaire of public consultations into one. So this system is the opposite in many ways of what we'd like to see in terms of accepted scientific evidentiary standards. Again, we want proponents to bear the burden of proof to establish that new interventions will do more good than harm. But under this system, opponents bear the burden of proof to establish that new interventions will do more harm than good. It also emphasizes transparency in word, but not in deed. The website says that the Better Regulation Agenda ensures evidence-based, transparent EU lawmaking based on the views of those impacted. But there's no mechanism to achieve transparency on data relevant to proposals like chat control, where there's a lot we don't know about it. For example, what kind of training data were used in building this tool? How was informed consent obtained for it, including from minors whose sexual texts and images may have been used, need to have been used in developing the tool? How does it differ from field data, potentially massively inflating accuracy? Is it true that, as critics said in an open letter, it must work by using a perceptual hash function comparison that could be defeated easily by dedicated attackers, potentially massively deflating error, also known as false negative rates? So there are no designated independent reviewers to evaluate the evidence of claimed costs and benefits. And if there were any, they wouldn't have any established way of accessing the information they need to do their job. There's nothing that says data must be collected to see how programs work, to evaluate how evidence-based they really are once policy proposals become law. So evidence-based policymaking and transparency seem to be either empty signifiers, things that mean very different things to different people, or virtue signals, things people talk about to look good socially and politically. In science, there are conventions that could help us here. That said, science has problems too. Science is in the midst of a so-called science crisis in which observers are realizing that scientists are human and they sometimes make mistakes, they're subject to cognitive biases, there's even a lot of fraud or unethical behavior in science. And there are also methodological advances, chiefly from the causal revolution that was spearheaded by Judea Pearl, UCLA Emeritus Professor and Cognitive Systems Laboratory Director, and his colleagues, that lets us draw causal logics in a way that makes for doing better science and statistics. But this innovation, among others, is still filtering down to practice in a lot of fields. So in science, we're also doing not perfect, but better. And one of the ways in which we're not perfect is that we're not neutral. Advancing evidentiary standards is therefore not a perfect solution to the problem of bias, be it in science or in policy. In fact, it raises the specter of a possible arms race of experts, where different sides could hire experts to argue their own point in relation to advanced evidentiary standards. And that's a legitimate criticism, I think, of this type of proposal, that advancing evidentiary standards could add another layer of delegated trust in a complex system rife with that trust and its abuse. I think that probably is a problem, but on the other hand, advancing evidentiary standards still seems better than not doing it, because there is no exit from the psychosocial swamp for any of us, and because there are perverse incentives for pseudoscience, really, in these programs. These incentives fall into four categories: psychosocial, political, legal, and financial. And in terms of psychosocial, I want to look at some positive feedback loops for lay people. They exist for lay people and for experts in ordering more and more mass screening tests. But I'm going to look just at this example. This is on the patient side. This is about psychosocial feedback loops in the medical context. This is a figure from Overdiagnosed by Gilbert Welsh, Lisa Schwartz, and Stephen Volishin. And what it shows is that screening exams can make people feel good when they get a normal result, then anxious if they get a false alarm, and then relieved and good again when they find out it was a false alarm. People who are identified as having consequential disease may die anyway, or they may truly be helped, in which case they think, oh, I owe my life to this early detection. Or they may be overdiagnosed, in which case they may never know that a cancer that was detected never would have bothered them, that they were overdiagnosed and overtreated, and they may instead think, oh, I owe my life to this early detection. in addition to this kind of psychosocial positive feedback loop, there are also political incentives for mass screenings for low prevalence problems, where politicians are incentivized to do something instead of doing nothing. It's more politically expedient. It's a stronger position also to stick with a program that you have proposed instead of learning more about it and admitting that you had cognitive bias. There are disincentives to do that. There can be a corporate profiteering aspect to this in terms of the infamous revolving door between industry and government. And we'll come back to this under financial. But I want to talk about asymmetric legal penalties for just a minute. In the context of mass screening tests, the overdiagnosed book authors had a wonderful anecdote about how in practice there are legal incentives for doctors to order these tests and disincentives for them to not order them. They told a story of a man who was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and the doctor who diagnosed him told him, oh, your other physician should have ordered the screening test, it would have saved your life, which was wrong. That's uncertain. But the man went back and sued his previous doctor and, you know, then was dying of cancer in the courtroom. And his lawyer said, you know, instructed him probably to bring his family in and have them cry. And, you know, he won the case because courtrooms are not necessarily places where science and statistics hold sway, right? Human emotion also matters and cognitive bias is pervasive. So the scientific reality doesn't necessarily determine the social one. And we can't escape that. That affects structural incentives. And then in terms of financial incentives, in terms of a typology, we might think about different types of incentives as local, regional, or national, or peripheral, central, and systemic. And the way that I like to think of them along those lines is to call them small fish, bigger fish, and biggest fish. And what I mean by that, for example, in medicine, is that doctors who own the means of production of producing medical information, especially you might think in terms of imaging, like a doctor who has an ultrasound machine in his or her office, they may make money off of doing the imaging, but just a little bit of money. But they do have that small incentive to do more imaging, to find more information and to bill for it. And then a hospital system may similarly, there was even an example, an overdiagnosed of a hospital system saying that they use mass screenings as a loss leader to bring a lot more future business to the hospital system. And then the biggest fish in the medical story are actors like pharmaceutical companies, which have played a hand in moving the thresholds for a number of so-called lifestyle diseases like hypertension, diabetes, osteoporosis, and high cholesterol. And that creates, you know, potentially millions of new clients for them overnight, while at the same time putting people at risk because the number of patients needed to treat for mild cases of these diseases is much higher, and the probability that there will be an adverse event for treatment from treatment is also much higher. And in the security context, the principle of all of these incentives also holds. For example, with chat control, the available accuracy estimates are based on unpublished analyses of unknown data from commercially interested sources. Chat control has been heavily promoted by Thorn, which is a group registered in the EU lobby database as a charity that has made millions from US Department of Homeland Security contracts for its AI tools. So across domains, mass screenings for low prevalence problems, accuracy rates are often generated by researchers with economic incentives to inflate them, and these accuracy rates cannot be verified when the tests cannot be validated in the real world. And I want to lean on this point because it takes us back to evidentiary standards. We need to think about accuracy both as a term of art, where there are perverse incentives for researchers to inflate accuracy rates. And in the colloquial sense, where we usually think about accuracy also as including false negatives. And in the security context, it's really important to remember that dedicated attackers can game the system, that's just a vulnerability inherent to these programs. So there's this double distortion in how well we're detecting the signal we're trying to detect, particularly in security contexts. This concludes my talk on mass screenings for low prevalence problems with a focus on chat control as a currently controversial case study of this dangerous structure of program. If you have any questions, comments, or case studies you would like to see added to the big trawling table, please leave a comment or reach out to me. Thank you for your time. I'm saying something.
Hi. We're back, and I've got Vera Wild with me right now to answer some of your questions. Vera, thank you very much for your talk. So
thank you for putting this together. This is an amazing event.
So why won't technology solve the issue? Why won't it get us out of the accuracy error dilemma in statistics? Can't we just develop more accurate software?
We can develop more accurate software, but we'll still be trapped in the accuracy error dilemma. And the reason is that we're working off of probabilistic cues, so there will always be mistakes in the mix. And technology can't solve that problem because technology is just something that we create to categorize the world, to help us in our categorization. But it doesn't act on the structure of the world. It doesn't change the fact that we're picking up on probabilistic cues, which means there will always be mistakes in these categorizations.
So even if we were to categorize perfectly, that just because of probabilistic, that just can't happen.
Right. Well, unless you have a cue where there's a one-to-one correspondence, which happens, but it's rare, where there's a one-to-one correspondence between this cue and this categorization. But usually the structure of the world is that we're looking at a lot of probabilistic cues, trying to figure out what inferences to make from a collection of probabilistic cues, and technology can't help us out there.
So even if we had a perfectly accurate algorithm, the world is just too messy to work it out properly.
I mean, we could have a perfectly accurate algorithm for something where there is a perfect correlation, right, between the cue and the categorization we want to make. That's just not the structure of most of the things that we want to know the answer to. Most of the things we're trying to categorize, the cues are messier than that. The world is messier than that.
Makes sense. So why aren't we making a trade-off for some liberty, for some security in mass surveillance programs?
That common framing of these debates reflects a cognitive bias known as statistical reification, where we have a model of outcomes, we have a model of how the world works, and we think, oh, well, that's how the world really works. But this is just an abstract hypothetical outcome spread when you look at the classic 2x2 confusion matrix of true and false negatives and positives. This is just a representation of where the outcomes could come out in a mass screening program. In reality, we're not sure about most particular cases where they should go. In particular, you know, if somebody claims they're a false positive in a security program, you don't really have any way of knowing if they're telling the truth or not. But even in the context of cancer, like I was talking about with mammography detection, a lot of people who have cancer screens that are positive never know if they're a false positive or not, because they don't know if that cancer would have really killed them or not.
The world is just kind of too messy, and we can't, while we might have some data in some part, and we have the screening, which, whatever it is, if it's cancer, if it is whether something on social media is content that should be removed, we just don't know if we act on it, if that is the correct action to take, and we cannot determine whether something is a false positive or an actual positive.
Exactly. There's more persistent uncertainty in the world than we like to accept. And when people talk about liberty versus security, they're assuming a certainty in the categorizations, and they're assuming that, for example, all false positives, that's a liberty cost, as opposed to there being facets of liberty and security in all of these boxes, which is how the world really works. It's just that messy.
And I mean, I guess it's also, even if we were to determine whether something is a false positive or not, it still leaves us with the problem that we have to set the boundary where something is a problem that we need to deal with and where something is a problem that is possible to ignore and not act upon, right? So that boundary is also difficult to set.
Yeah, that's a very important component of these questions. Also in medicine, but certainly in security, that can be taboo. But I'm glad you raised that. That's a very important issue.
So in medicine, the equivalent to that would be that, for example, we have a cancer screening and it's just difficult to tell, like weighing the probability of a certain case of cancer killing the patient versus the probability of the medical treatment or the decrease in life expectancy from the treatment, and weighing those components against each other, that just gets really messy really quickly.
Yeah, exactly. Especially the case I was thinking of in medicine is with DCIS in breast cancer, which is ductal cell carcinoma in situ. And it's a cancer that there's debate about the proportion of cases that will progress to a cancer that has clinical significance. But it's thought that most of these are benign. And so you have women who get false flags, and then they undergo sometimes mastectomy. They undergo really radical surgery, and they go... There's one case in particular of a member of parliament in Britain, Don Butler, who, you know, had a million missed mammograms campaign to get women to get their mammograms again after COVID had shut the program down, because she thinks that the surgery saved her life, but she was diagnosed with DCIS. So we don't know. That's misinformation. And it's difficult to get people to think critically about, especially when they've been through something like really life-threatening surgery, that maybe they weren't fully informed about that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Honestly, it just shows you how statistics can only get us so far, and the world once again reappears and is messier than it looks in statistical models.
Absolutely, and then our heads, our ways of dealing with it are yet messier.
Let me check if we have any further questions from the chat. Too many tabs to click through. I can't see any right now. Do you have anything you would like to add?
No, I know you guys went to a great deal of time and effort and expense pulling this all together, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you also very much for your talk. Mm-hmm.